today will probably provoke a great deal of discussion, so I would like to leave as much time for that as possible. We have as our, this is the last of the five topics that I'm doing on the subject, the general subject of death. To review the week for any of you that are in for the first time, we spent Monday talking about death in American culture, and particularly the relationship between a secular culture and the denial of death, which is, I think, the fundamental characteristic of our culture's treatment of death. On Tuesday, we talked about care of the death and dying, of the dying and the bereaved, particularly with the help of the work of Dr. Elizabeth Kubler-Ross. On Wednesday, we talked about the language of Christian hope. Yesterday, burial rituals that are congruent with Christian faith. And today, we're going to talk about ethical questions with regard to death. The subject has really been around for a long time. There's nothing new about it, but there is a new urgency to at least some of the topics. I would like to list, first of all, briefly, the general topics that I think come under this subject, and these would be the inflicting of death on other people, murder, capital punishment, war, all of which have as their object bringing life to an end. Then related to this now is the ongoing argument on abortion. We have not solved this question simply with the work of the Supreme Court. Right to life groups are springing up and in fact are continuing all over the country, and are protesting at least the moral, if not the legal, practice of abortion. Then there is the age-old question of euthanasia and suicide, bringing about someone's death in a situation where death seems the preferable alternative, whether you do this by your own hand in suicide or whether you have someone do it for you. And finally, now, very recently, the question about the right to die, that is, the patient's right to terminate treatment on himself or herself. And I think coupled with that, we have to take up the whole question that has been raised now by transplants, organ transplants, and the need for donors to supply kidneys and hearts, especially for purposes of transplant. The problem is compounded because we do not have today a single universally accepted definition for death. We know when death has occurred, that is, after a certain period of time, when it has occurred, but crucial to the whole question of organ transplants is the definition at which a physician or a surgeon may legitimately remove an organ from a human being and transplant it into the body of another human being. This question is one that I'm not going to be able to shed a great deal of light on, but perhaps I can at least indicate the parameters within which the discussion is taking place. The older definition of death by which most of us operated was that death means the cessation of heartbeat or the cessation of breathing. And both of these, if they cease over a period of minutes, can be regarded as having brought about death. But this no longer seems to be, at least, an adequate or workable definition of death, because it's possible for us today with machines and stimuli to keep bodily functions going long after the brain has ceased to function in what has come to be called irreversible coma. It seems to be possible today to measure coma, irreversible coma, with so-called brain waves, and the question arises, should the body be kept alive, should the heart be kept functioning, the lungs and so on, when it is clear from other evidence that irreversible coma has set in, or brain damage? It's possible for us to keep people alive a long time, years in fact, without them functioning in any conscious or at least discernibly conscious way. There are a lot of things that we don't know about at this point. I hope that at some time in the future, some kind of universally acceptable definition of death will emerge from the discussion between lawyers and doctors and theologians and researchers, so that the whole question of transplants can be settled. So that's, I think, the one that we are probably least in a position to say anything definitive about, but it may be that there want to be, that you'll want to have some discussion on this. What about all of the others? Suicide, right to die, euthanasia, as well as the social problems, abortion, murder, capital punishment, and war. Let me try to stake out some general principles, first of all. The first of these more or less general principles is, I think that for Lutherans especially, it's important for us to rethink the foundation of government. I don't know what it was like in your own catechetical instruction, but when I was a boy, we were generally taught that government has its basis, human government, has its divine basis in the fourth commandment. That is the commandment dealing with parental authority. Luther explains it this way in both the small and the large catechism. What does it mean that we should honor father and mother? It means, says Luther, we should fear and love God that we may obey our parents and masters. And by extension, he says in the larger catechism that this also includes government. So Luther derived government from parental authority. And indeed, this was very much the image which the feudal rulers had of themselves. Kings, dukes, counts, and numerous others thought of themselves literally as the fathers of their people. Some of them were that in more than one sense, promiscuity being what it was. But they thought of themselves as the fathers of their people and exercised a kind of parental care and parental authority over them. Government was largely patriarchal. Now, I think, however, that this teaching of Luther's, which has been passed on to a great many of us, has all sorts of problems within it, because the goal of parental authority is to set the child free from the parent. In other words, it is not to perpetuate authority, but literally to educate children in such a way that they themselves will be free of parental authority. This is a graduated process, as all of us know, but at certain points in our lives, all of us are free of the authority of our parents. We are literally on our own. I think, therefore, that it would be more wise for us to understand the grounding of the commandment on parental parent-child relationships to be the grounding for the educational enterprise. To honor father and mother means to pay attention to the accumulated wisdom of the human race, to honor this wisdom in its transmission and to honor it precisely by habituating ourselves to it so that we can be responsible, functioning adult individuals. In short, the fourth commandment therefore grounds the educational enterprise. All teachers know that you teach not to make students dependent on you, but independent of you. That's the goal. What then is the grounding for government? I think, strangely, the fifth commandment, thou shalt do no murder. That is the grounding for government in a fallen world. Because murder is the ultimate, or let me put it this way, the taking of life is the ultimate exercise of coercive authority. To threaten your life, you see, to threaten to take your life away from you is the ultimate way in which I can force you to do my bidding. Sometimes the mere hint of the threat is sufficient. The policeman rarely has to draw his gun. The mere hint of it is enough to force us to over to the side of the road when the red light flashes, or to march in a certain place when we are asked to, and so on. All violent crime has the taking of life as its coercive force. Now, this means, therefore, that in order for human society to exist, in order for people to function with relative responsibility toward each other, there must be a prohibition. There must be a power that prevents us from taking life. Now, that, I think, is the origin and the function of government. Government does not mean that the society has the right to take life, but the individual does not. Government literally means no one has the right to take life. So that whenever there is the taking of life, whenever murder occurs, whenever we inflict death on one another, we do not have so much the exercise of government as its breakdown. Now, we've learned to function within certain conventions. In war, for example, we say that armies can threaten the lives of each other with relative immunity, and nobody prosecutes then a war maker as a criminal, although even in that respect the 20th century has some interesting novel precedents for us. But at least we must recognize that when wars occur, we do not have government functioning, we have the breakdown of government. Normal relationships between nations have been replaced by warring relationships. Many soldiers tell us that this breakdown of government is precisely what happens in those areas where you still don't have military police moving in. I was quite surprised to discover when I came to Germany in 1954 that that many of the Germans had stories to tell about the kind of treatment they received from American and French and British soldiers whose only law was the weapon that they held. There was a good deal of looting and rape and simple exploitation in the hours between the moving in of the army and the follow-up of the military police. So war, among other things, is a breakdown of government. Now, that's the first point. The grounding of government is the command, thou shalt do no murder. And I understand it to be an absolute one. Where there is murder, where there is killing, where there is taking of life, government has broken down. The second principle, I think, that I generally tend to operate with in the larger sphere of society now is that all of us human beings are relatively untrustworthy. Relatively untrustworthy. That is, we can be trusted only to look out for our own interests at all times. We cannot be totally trusted with the interests of another human being. None of us. Now, I think that may sound like an unduly pessimistic view of man, but I think it is also a justifiable one. Most of the agencies and institutions that we have created for human governance are institutions that are based on the relative untrustworthiness of human beings, or if we have not built this into our system, the society itself is an inequitable and an unjust one. I think one of the most helpful books that I have read in recent years has been a book by Hannah Arendt on revolution, in which she compared the American and the French Revolution in the 18th century. The American Revolution, she says, was based on relative pessimism about the nature of man. The American theorists of the revolution said the people are wise enough and good enough to govern themselves, but rather no man is good enough to be trusted with absolute power. And therefore the institutions which the American Revolution forged were institutions designed to place limits on the absolute power of anybody or any individual within the institutions of government. Now that represents a fundamentally pessimistic view of man, and I think it's made our own governmental institutions more durable than those of the revolutions based on optimism about man. The French Revolution would be the prime example from the 18th, and the Marxist the prime example from the 20th century. These are revolutions based on at least a certain amount of optimism. The people, the vox populi, vox dei, the voice of the people is the voice of God, or the proletariat, you see. If once we can have a classless society, then the proletariat will rule with justice and equity. Neither of those have been borne out to be true. The optimism was unjustified, both in France in the 18th century and in Russia and other countries in the 20th. So I think what I want to say here is that the institutions for governance which we have forged for ourselves are institutions that have as their fundamental premise our own relative untrustworthiness. We are really not finally to be trusted with the ultimate destiny of any other individual. None of us can really have power, life and death power, over another individual. Now, if we take these two premises into account, that in a fallen world the basis for government is thou shalt do no murder, and therefore we need institutions to protect us from one another, it begins to be clear that the direction in which I'm heading. I want to add to this now one third general principle, namely the principle that most of the questions that we have to deal with in the ethical realm do not admit of right and wrong answers. We are dealing with shades of gray, and we have to come to terms with the ambiguities involved. We are going to only be able to achieve relatively equitable and relatively just solutions to the ethical problems that confront us. Part of what I'm saying, therefore, is that for every decision that we make, there is a corresponding price to be paid. I think the clearest example of this is the whole question of abortion. I tend generally to be opposed to abortion except on therapeutic grounds. The price that the so-called right-to-life groups will probably have to pay for this is massive attention to the causes for unwanted pregnancy. I think some of the causes for unwanted pregnancy are ignorance, or the whole romantic notion that we have, or even the medieval understanding of the distinction between mortal and venial sin. I'll come to that in a moment. And part of it is the psychological trauma that home and family life in America inflicts on teenage and younger people today. So that if we are really opposed to abortion, we cannot simply say, forbid it. The evils of absolute prohibition to abortion are well known to all of us. We have not stopped abortions at all. We have only transferred them to the realm of the illegal. They frequently then take place in unsanitary, disastrous conditions and work harm on the mothers as well as the unborn. But the price for opposing abortion must be a reconsideration of other areas of our public life. Let me take the mortal venial sin thing just for a moment. In the Middle Ages, people were taught that there were two kinds of sin. Mortal sin was a sin that you committed willfully, deliberately, with conscious forethought and preparation. Venial sin were the sort of accidental ones, the ones that happened without conscious thought and preparation. Mortal sin had to be confessed and absolved. If you died in mortal sin, you would go straight to hell. This is why in Hamlet, for example, when Hamlet sees his uncle kneeling in what he thinks is prayer, he does not kill him because that isn't a bad enough fate. He wants to send him to hell, so he hopes to catch him in the middle of a mortal sin. Then he will dispatch him, you see. Now, what does all this have to do with sex? Well, it has made whole generations of young couples very wary of planning sexual intercourse in advance on an evening. But if it just happens, you see, if they just happen to be carried away, that's only a venial sin. And so it isn't the same thing as a mortal sin. Well, whole realms of ethical questions are involved here. I think, if we are going to be opposed to abortion on grounds of the principles that I've tried to lay out, the price for this is much more intensive attention to the social and moral attitudes behind unwanted pregnancies. I think we're going to have to provide a lot more information on contraception in homes and families and schools and the public generally, so that unwanted pregnancies do not occur. And that gets us into whole other realms that we probably don't have time to talk about this afternoon. My point is that in a fallen world, there are prices to be paid for every policy decision that we have, or for every perspective that we try to effect in our society. I think probably the questions that concern us most in the realm of death are not so much the public policy ones, should we or should we not go to war, should we or should we not be pacifists, should we or should we not have capital punishment and abortion, but primarily the questions that have to do now with euthanasia and the so-called right to die. Let me address myself to those two briefly, and then we can open it up for general discussion. Euthanasia means the inflicting of death by the hand of another person when the alternative, namely staying alive, is worse than being killed. Examples of this would be the young man in New Jersey who was injured in a motorcycle accident and was told that he was going to be paralyzed for life from the neck down, so he asked his brother to put an end to his life. The brother procured a gun or got a gun from somewhere, came into his hospital room, asked him once more, "Do you want me to do this?" And the boy said yes, and so his brother put the gun to his head and shot him. There was a trial. The jury verdict was not guilty by virtue of temporary insanity. I think, or another example, another classic example, was the case in Holland where a woman's mother was dying of a very painful form of cancer, and in her moments of relative consciousness between administrations of pain-killing medication, she asked her daughter to end her suffering, and the daughter then smothered her mother with a pillow. She was also tried in a court and found she was either found guilty and given a suspended sentence or found not guilty again by reason of insanity. Now, I think here we confront ourselves once again with particularly cruel dilemmas where it is again revealed what kinds of ambiguities we are confronted with in a fallen world. I would be terribly fearful of any legislation which would give carte blanche to individuals to administer so-called mercy killing or euthanasia. I think the temptations for abuse of such legislation would be much more than sinful human beings could bear. Nevertheless, every one of us, or at least most of us, have perhaps already in our lives been confronted with the sufferings of people whom we love very dearly and whose pain hurts us excruciatingly ourselves. In my first parish, I watched the wife of one of my parishioners die over a 2-year period of a bone cancer that was terribly painful. And the last 6 months of her life were just drugged, stupefied existence. The hospital bills were enormous. They were staggering. The family was on the verge of financial collapse at the end of this lengthy hospitalization. All kinds of things. Now, I don't know what it is really like to be in the situation where someone whom I love and who trusts me and depends on me would actually ask me to terminate a life. I don't know what I would do in that kind of a situation. But I think that the solutions that have generally been found by juries are probably the best that we can hope for in this kind of a circumstance. I think that people must be tried, at least put on trial, for every act of violence against another human being, including these kinds of situations. And then I think we must simply ask juries to try to determine a verdict that may not always be legal, but may certainly be right. There's a taxi driver who gets quoted frequently who said to somebody somewhere a long time ago, "Sometimes you just have to forget your principles and do the right thing." the this may be one of those cases. To find a man not guilty by reason of temporary insanity may not fit any of the legal definitions that we have for responsibility or insanity, but it may still be the right verdict. The problem, however, with leaving the whole matter here in the hands of juries is that juries in some parts of the country are not apt to have the same collective wisdom as, let's say, a jury in New Jersey or the judges in Holland. The more perplexing question may well be, what about prolonged treatment? That is, what medical people sometimes call heroic measures to prolong life. Normally, responsibly, where we become a burden to relatives or to the public, where we lie in beds with developing bed sores and creating all kinds of problems for people who have to care for us and really aren't any longer able to enjoy the kinds of things that we could enjoy or even to be companionable to people who were our companions and friends, that at that point we really ought to have the option to say, the quality of my life has deteriorated to the point where I don't want anybody to do anything for me anymore. You may not actually hasten my own death, but at least don't prolong it. Is that ethical? Is it in fact a form of suicide? If means are available to keep us alive, ought we to prolong life? I find it very difficult to give again a clear-cut answer on my own to this. I think that the experience of my father's death is still too vivid for me. He was told that he could have cobalt treatment for his cancer. He was already an invalid. The doctors explained to him that cobalt therapy would possibly prolong his life for some months, but that there would also be side effects which would make caring for him more difficult and his own life a little bit more embarrassing and less dignified than it had been. With my mother, he decided not to have the cobalt treatments, and he died within about 2.5 weeks after he made that decision. I think it was the right decision for him to make, and no heroic measures were employed. I guess I would tend to think that people who are able to participate in the decisions regarding their own care ought to be able to do so. I think the recent death of Wayne Morse was another example of this, wasn't it? He could have had kidney treatment, kidney dialysis, and he chose not to, and died within several days after making that decision. Wherever possible, I guess I would say, first of all, I think people ought to be allowed to participate in the kinds of treatment that they are allowed to have. And I think I would want to affirm and support the decisions of those people who decide against heroic measures to preserve their own lives. What if, however, you are no longer capable of making decisions? What if you are injured in such a way that you can't participate in diagnosis and prognosis and decision about your treatment? Ms. Manis, in her book, suggests something that is widely current today, namely a so-called living will, in which you direct any people responsible for your own care not to take heroic measures to preserve your life if you are injured and cannot be expected to recover so that you can have the same quality of life as you had before your injury. The form of such a will, I didn't bring one along. I was looking for it. I thought I'd brought one along. But it's a simple form. You can execute it with your lawyer, or I suppose you can just draw it up yourself. I don't know that it is legally binding. The information that I have is that it is not legally binding. You cannot order people to pull the plug on you, so to speak, with the force of law. But I think it can be a source of easing of the consciences of those who are responsible for your care and treatment. And this perhaps brings me now to the implication of the second point that I wanted to make, namely that none of us are finally fully trustworthy. We're all relatively untrustworthy. I think that it is advisable, and I hope probably, I hope that the machinery for this can be created, that a group of people can be made responsible for these decisions. That group of people should be made up of at least a lawyer, a physician, clergyman, probably a psychologist, and one member of the family in the case where a decision to pull the plug has to be made. I think if we have that kind of shared responsibility, there is less possibility of a capricious, arbitrary, or self-motivated decision being made. You know, if your rich aunt is about to die, and you know that she's not leaving her money to the pregnant cat that Leo Bustead talked about, but to you, you ought not to make the decision as to whether or not to pull the plug in her case. And a group of people is there to guard against your own proclivity for self-interest. Well, I think I've raised far more questions than we can solve this afternoon. But I would like to give us at least 20 minutes or so for discussion, give and take, exchange of ideas on this topic. Where do you want to begin? With which of the many ethical problems? Leo, are you up there? Do you have anything to add to what I've said? You want to start us off?
I'll read you a paragraph that I first wrote.
All right.
In the summer dialogue, Dr. Walter Sackett, M.D., has introduced euthanasia bills in the four legislatures since 1969. He's proposed that up to 90% of the 1,500 patients in Florida hospitals for the mentally retarded should be allowed to die, and the doctors should be allowed to terminate life-sustaining drugs for mongoloid children, thus saving several billion dollars if they would be allowed to succumb to pneumonia, which they are especially susceptible. His proposals have become bolder. He is not alone. Governor Tom McCall of Oregon has also been pushing for euthanasia legislation. I fully expect many churches left indefensible because of their positions on abortion to accommodate and get on the bandwagon. This is America. We stood in judgment of the doctors in Nuremberg. We wondered how it all started, how the physically defective, the mentally ill, and the Jews could be subjected to experimentation for the death. Simplistically, we have blamed Hitler choosing a place of comfort in the one-man theory of evil. But the plain fact is the process began before Hitler, not with a riffraff, but at the university. In 1920, a book by the famous jurist Carl Bindung and psychiatrist Albert Hope set the stage. It was called The Release of the Destruction of Life Devoid of Value. It advocated that the killing of the worthless people be released from the penalty and legally and be legally permitted. Medical doctors were not ordered by Hitler or his cohorts to inaugurate a program to exterminate the 275,000 or more psychiatric patients they killed. The doctors acted on their own. Thousands of children were also disposed of, the retarded, handicapped mongoloid, some of whom had only defective ears. The trusted healer became the killer. Not infrequently, I have almost wished I had never studied in Germany, had never read the Nazi Jugendwaffen, had never visited Dachau, which is kept as a memorial to honor the dead and admonish the living. And I saw some of these people in the semi-live state. They were dead, but some of them didn't have sense enough to lay down. They were a horror to behold. I almost wish I had never read what One America wrote in the guest book there. Thank God this could never happen in America.
I just want to add, I think I'm reading in this paper that the Association for Retired Citizens put out this spring. There were quite a, you know, uproar about this in Florida, and I believe, I don't know if there's like a petition now,
what I hear you saying with that paragraph is support for my general principles that we are relatively untrustworthy and we better not give ourselves the legal authority to take another person's life, no matter how high and worthy and noble the motive, and that government exists to keep us from doing that rather than to permit us.
Economic considerations should not always be the final decision.
All right, that's what I hear you saying. Now, where is everybody else on this? Hand here?
When I oppose abortion, it's pretty basic, but also because I'm growing older and I feel if you can take life at that stage, what's going to keep someone from saying that when I'm past 65 and can't contribute to society that I'm sick too?
I hear you, Jan.
That argument kind of bothers me a little bit though, because it's a logical fallacy. To take something to its extreme, that you can't do this because this may happen. I mean, there are ways we can stop things from going that far. I think almost on anything we do in our personal lives, in our society, if we extended it to its extreme, it would be horrible. You know, and we need government for moderation as well. But I wanted to raise another question that you may have raised before I came in, and that was, what right does the church have or responsibility to for entire moral statements about these very ambiguous, difficult issues that are absolute, that to say, cannot do this, you know, for the Christian to follow.
Did you hear me saying that?
No, I didn't. You're talking about government. So I didn't know what
yes, and I think that that's where these kinds of questions belong.
Oh, yeah.
What we are dealing with here is largely, I think, public policy. And when we are dealing with public policy, I may frequently be a participant in policies that I myself would not want to take advantage of. But I would support them as public policies. Because in the public realm, we are trying to deal with the preservation of a fallen world and a fallen society. We're not trying to redeem it. We're simply trying to keep it functioning. When we are, I think, in that area, I do not believe that the Christian community has an obligation or even should be given the opportunity to determine public policy on the basis of its own insights and concerns. I think we saw what happened when the church got a chance to do that. We had the Middle Ages, and we had the Inquisition, and we had, I think, an incredible blot on the life of the community. What the church revealed in the Middle Ages was that it was as sinful as everybody else when it got its hands on power. Now, I think, therefore, that the Christian church does not have the right or the calling, the vocation, to determine public policy. I'm opposed to divorce as a personal matter, but I am very glad for the regulation of divorce and even for the easing of the possibility of divorce in no-fault divorce actions such as California now has. I'm against it, but I support the public policy. I'm personally against abortion, but I support the regulation of the practice so that it comes under the care of licensed physicians in qualified and sanitary circumstances. But I think that my responsibilities as a citizen here also force me to see what kinds of measures can be taken, public policy measures again, as well as measures by the initiative of groups and private individuals, to prevent the need for some of these things. In other words, what can we do to build a better basis for marriage? Is romance, you see, the only thing that we have going for us as a basis for marriage? Should we allow that to happen? If we do, what are the consequences of that? What does it mean that young people today are encouraged in early dating because the parents don't make the choices any longer, the person does. So he's frantic about getting into the dating game, and frantic when he's or she is a senior in college and they have not yet fallen in love. What are we really doing, you see, to cope with a lot of these problems? Same thing is true with abortion. What are we doing to cope with the problems that produce unwanted pregnancies, you see? So I, you know, as a citizen, I think I have many different kinds of responsibilities, none of which includes saying this must under no circumstances ever take place. I don't think the church has the wisdom or the vocation to say that. Please.
Let's get back to euthanasia again. And I think that, you know, I'm pretty sure that I'm completely against, you know, ever medically getting rid of people that are old and stuff. But then I, being a nurse, I run into the problems where patients will say to me, you know, I'll come in with some medicine and they'll say, please don't give me that, you know, because I want to die, and keeping them alive, you know. Or else their relatives want them alive, but they don't want them to be alive, or the opposite way, you know. And, you know, it's really frustrating to, you know, what to do.
Yeah.
You know, because, I don't know, and there's a lot of times bad rapport between doctors and nurses, too, because doctors seem to do an awful lot, you know, keep somebody alive, and the person doesn't want to stay alive, you know, and they say to us, you know, why don't they let me die? That's what I want to do,
yeah.
But they don't, and then the question comes whether or not they are fit to decide whether they want to die or not, you know, and you don't know, because some people when they, you know, and this idea of making out this will before you get sick, and that it seems to me would be very hard, because now I would not want any heroic measures done for me, but sometimes those heroic measures work, you know, and people stay alive. You know, I've seen people be on respirators, and all we're doing is just supporting them, you know, waiting for them to die, and you know, a month later they walk out of the hospital.
I know.
You know, and it's really a hard thing, because sometimes people are able to decide, you know, but sometimes people just hang on to their life, you know, no matter what they have to go through.
Yeah.
And it's really, really frustrating for me, I find it, you know. I was taking care of an old man that was, must have been like 90, and for the last month all he's, you know, has said is, you know, I want to die. And he's been in the hospital for 6 months. You know, and I think it's gotten to be where So the doctors just feel like they can't give up on them. They put too much into them. And that's true, because he wants to die. He's 90 years old, you know. He's made his peace with God, he says, and he wants to die. He can't walk around. He can't walk. He has a hard time breathing, and they don't listen to him anymore.
I wish I had some wisdom for you. I don't. That's why I think we need collective wisdom. Here.
I'm also a nurse, and I'm thinking of the agony on the other side. I saw a 94-year-old lady with an abdominal aneurysm, which they said was the size of a baseball, threatening to rupture. And they said that maybe she couldn't even make the decision whether she should have the surgery for the family. So she said Kim had to make that decision. And when they signed for it, and I was just agonizing, saying if that were my mother, I wouldn't put her through that. She can't possibly go through that surgery. Yet within 3 weeks, that lady walked out of the hospital. It was a very difficult decision.
Anybody else on this? Yes, please.
If we go back to Keebler or Ross, we find out that often people say one thing in an effort to cry out to you to say something different back to them. Maybe when I say, let me die, I'm really saying, you know, all of you come around and pay me some attention. I need your moral support, your love.
Yes, please, Sash.
I have a friend who is dying, and to go see him in the hospital, his body, there's almost nothing left to it. And to watch his body rotting away is one of those frightening things. And he can barely talk now. But one of the most frightening things I've observed is that he still thinks, and there's still a mind there, and Ed is still there. Yet his body is rotting before our very eyes. He cannot move, he's barely existing. He is now being fed through a hole in his stomach. And that's all he's got going, but he has that mind. And as much as we pray at times, you know, really pray, God, take him. He still has that mind there that you don't want to, that you know there's still something there, something that can still communicate with the living. And that's what's so hard to watch.
See, the question or the concern that I hear you raising is the concern for what constitutes human existence. I think this is one of the questions that keeps being asked in the controversy over abortion. You know, when do we have human existence? When is a fetus human? And it's the same sort of thing that's asked at the other end, you know, when has human life ceased? Is it simply the cessation of the biological functions? That's at least what I hear you voicing, a concern. Carol?
I think, in a way, we're terribly, terribly hung up on the taking of life. And you should be, of course, because, you know, murder is murder. And I went through the whole thing on abortion. I'm against it, but I was glad when the law was passed that gave people a choice. But the choice had to be there. And I think a lot of, especially the people who were in abortion, who were for abortion, always sidestepped that basic issue that yes, a life was being taken, and that cannot be glossed over in any way, whether it is someone who you pull the plug on or who is aborted. That is killing, you know. But I don't think that because that word sounds so horrible, we should be paralyzed by it.
It's never prevented us from waging war, for
right,
example.
Right, exactly. Yeah. So I think of Aristotle Onassis, his son, who was very young and who, I don't know, about a year ago was killed in a plane or was injured terribly in a plane crash. And he said, no, do not keep him alive. Yeah, he was just in terribly bad condition. And, and the doctor said that they could keep him alive. And he said, no.
Don't bother, right?
Yeah.
Please. Chief.
I would just like to throw in the question about the distinction of prolonging life and prolonging death. It seems to me a lot of times there, some of our medical majors, whether they're heroic or not, are a prolongation of the death process.
But that puts us squarely into the dilemma then that you were talking about, namely, you know, when are you prolonging life or making life possible again, and when are you simply prolonging the dying process? Our time is almost up this afternoon. I think I'd like to say two things to sort of conclude this week. The first of these has to do with what we've been talking about this afternoon. I think when I, at least, confront in concrete situations, as so many of you have expressed them this afternoon, all of the ambiguities of life, all of the gray areas, I become again profoundly aware of the freedom that we have from grace, that is given to us by grace. And I begin to understand all over again what Luther meant when he said sin boldly. Sin boldly is the word to a man who is immobilized by the moral dilemmas and the moral ambiguities of life. It's not an excuse, as William Temple once put it in a limerick, to find the best sin and commit it. No, Luther's word, sin boldly, is really a word that comes out of a profound experience of the grace of God. That experience which says God affirms us in the midst of the ambiguities of life and the terrible moral decisions that we have to make. For we are not justified before God by the correctness of our decisions, but rather by his own gift of love to us, by his own becoming vulnerable in our world in Jesus Christ. So that's the one word. I think it should be a freeing word for people, relatives and friends, nurses and doctors and all individuals who bump heads with the hard and ambiguous realities of life. And the second thing I wanted to say is a more general word about death and Christianity. Christian faith is always faith in the grace of God. It is not commitment to a viewpoint that seeks to disarm death. We don't believe doctrines about immortality or resurrection. We believe God, and we believe him because he has been gracious to us. That means, then, that we are also free to let death be what it is. Because we have used our personhood to protect ourselves, to defend ourselves, to justify ourselves, because of this, death comes to us as a judgment. If we believe doctrines about death, then we are trying to escape that judgment. But if we believe the gospel, then we are able to experience the fact of death and the judgment in death without flinching. What gets said to us in the Christian gospel is not judgment, but rather God's surprising, unpredicted, unmerited troubling of himself about us. Faith trusts that about God. And therefore we are all able to live and to die in the expectation that God continues to be the kind